The projector starts, and so begins this episode of Movie Nights and Matinees, the podcast for people who enjoy movies from when we actually had to go to the movies. I'm your host, Bill Groves, and this is episode 30, Here Comes the Cavalry, in which Jim and I are joined by a returning guest to talk about a trio of classic films from one of Hollywood's legendary directors. So, everybody saddle up and let's ride.
$13 a month, their diet beans and hay. Maybe horse meat before this campaign is over. Fight over cards or rut-gut whiskey, but share the last drop in their canteens. Faces may change, names, but they're there. They're the regiment, the regular army. Now and 50 years from now.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for listening. Before I welcome today's guest, I want to welcome back my co-host, Jim Reed, whom I've been without for the last three episodes. Initially, that was due to his being at the Kansas Silent Film Festival. So, Jim, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Before we launch into today's topic, do you want to kind of give us a recap on the festival and its highlights?
Yeah, we had some really interesting films. We ran the 1926 film with an all-black cast called The Flying Ace, about World War I aviation, and it was really interesting. I'd never seen that before. You know, I run the 16-millimeter films, which some of them are 16-millimeter. Any of the new restorations, of course, are always on video. But so I only ran three prints this year, and one of them was Lilac Time, which is something that had always escaped me. I'd never gotten to see it. So that was really interesting. And then we ran Navigator and Good Keaton and Paths to Paradise with Raymond Griffith, and Captain January with Baby Peggy, Nanook of the North, which didn't get any better with this viewing. I've never been one of my favorites. And then a really interesting German production called The Ancient Law about the Jews in Europe. And then that ran along with that was a Max Davidson short called Jewish Prudence. And, you know, all the films are all silent. They all have live accompaniment, you know, and some really good musicians there. Ben Model is there, and the Mon Alto Orchestra is usually there. I don't think they were there this year. And then some local Kansas musicians. But it was a really good turnout. You know, it's always free. There's no admission. And we had some packed houses this time.
Very good. It's good to have Jim back. And it's equally good to welcome back a guest from last year. When I last spoke with Michael Blake, it was with regard to one of his two major cinematic passions, Lon Chaney. Today, we're going to explore his other passion, director John Ford. As it happens, Michael has just published his latest book, which focuses on Ford's Cavalry Trilogy, starring John Wayne. The book is esoterically titled The Cavalry Trilogy, John Ford, John Wayne, and the Making of Three Classic Westerns. So, Michael, welcome back to Movie Nights and Matinees.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So I should begin by asking, because we covered this in regard to Lon Chaney, but what was it that spawned your interest in and appreciation for John Ford as a director?
Well, it started when my dad took me to a roadshow matinee performance of Cheyenne Autumn at the Pantages Theater. And it was a Western, so as a cowboy crazy kid, I was happy. Cavalry, Indians. But then on the big screen, I saw Monument Valley, and I just fell in love with that place. And as time went on, my dad introduced me to more and more John Ford films as they aired on our local TV stations. And he'd explain things about Ford and tell me about Ford. And before I knew it, I was hooked on Ford, and I still am. I think he is the greatest American cinema director there is. And he's got four Oscars to back that up, total of five nominations. One he didn't win for was Stagecoach in 1939. and he has won 2 Oscars for Best Short Subject, Battle of Midway and December 7. And that record of 4 directing Oscars has never been topped by anyone.
I think it's kind of ironic that the one that he didn't win the Oscar for was Stagecoach, since that's probably the first one that comes to mind for the average moviegoer who hasn't necessarily done a deep dive on his list of films. I think maybe that, The Searchers, The Quiet Man, maybe The Informer. But otherwise, yeah, Stagecoach seems to me would be the one that people would think of initially. Well, what was it that prompted you to write this book?
Well, I've wanted to write it for several years. It was always on my horizon to do. And then the first TR book spawned a second book on Theodore Roosevelt. So everything always kept getting pushed to the back. And finally, I just said, I've got to do this or it's never going to get done. And in 2019, pre-COVID, thank God, I started doing research and got myself to the Academy Library and places like that and started doing it. And luckily, I got complete access to John Ford's collection at Lilly Library from his grandson, Dan Ford. And luckily, all that was digitized. So I got that during COVID because everything else was shut down. You couldn't get into an archive at all. Throughout COVID, I just sat there banging away on the computer writing it. I always felt it needed the attention it never got. Word count is always an enemy of an author, especially if you're doing a biography on somebody like Ford or even John Wayne, because you've got so many things to cover. And you can only devote so much time or so much space to certain films because of, your word count problem. So a lot of things got lost in the shuffle on these 3 films. So I decided, much like the Calvary in a John Ford film, I'd come to the rescue of those 3 films.
Very apropos. And as far as the format of the book, one thing that I liked was that, I guess it has what you would expect from a film reference book and the subject matter it's covering. But one thing I thought was interesting was the way you went in and on the films, you give almost an expanded, there's a synopsis of the plot, which is to be expected, but it's almost like an expanded version because you talk about the script, how that compares to the way it was filmed. So kind of getting an, I wouldn't say a director's cut because sometimes those aren't necessarily extended. You're kind of sharing pretty much all the elements that were there to go into the film, including the ones that didn't. Am I making sense?
Yes. Any movie, well, first off, they were all based on, all 3 films were based on short stories by James Warner Bella. So I give a brief synopsis of the Bella story. Ford always liked short stories to do a movie with rather than a novel, because a novel, you had so much, well, do I keep this? Do I cut this? Blah, 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 blah. With the short story, you got a basic theme here. And then he and the writer can build upon that and expand the storyline, expand the characters, give more flesh and bone to the characters, if you will. So he always liked the short stories to base movies off of. So I use that. And then, of course, every time you see a script, it's going to change. My God, I can't tell you how many times on Spider-Man 3, we must have run the gamut of rainbow pages. The original script is all in white pages. Then they revise, say, a scene. So then those scenes become kind of a pink page, and then they revise this, and then it becomes yellow, and then it becomes blue. And before you know it, you do have a rainbow of colors. Not so much in Ford films. Pretty much what was in the script was in the script, and Ford went along, as Wayne always said, he could come along and pull out pages of dialogue and just get to the meat of the scene. And it made so much sense. And there were things in the script that probably along the way while he's filming, he goes, this is hurting the rhythm of the film. Let's drop the scene. Or he shot it and then went back and thinking, said, no, let's cut this. Like a great case in point is Fort Apache. Shirley Temple goes to ask some of the other officers' wives to help furnish their headquarters. And so they bring in all sorts of things. And Guy Cabi brings in this chair for Henry Fonda to sit in. And he said, yes, it's very nice. And he sits in the chair, and the chair legs go out from underneath him. Later in the scene, when Henry Fonda comes home, he finds the whole place furnished. He goes to sit down in that chair. Same thing happens to him. And he has to be helped out of the chair. Well, the joke is Henry Fonda getting stuck in the chair. The other part of the joke with Guy Cabi, you were ruining it. So Ford cut the Guy Cabi sequence out and kept the Henry Fonda falling in the chair, because then it was funny. Otherwise, if he had left both in, it would have been repetitive and not humorous.
Okay. This is a more general question, but how is a John Ford Western different from other Westerns?
Oh, boy, that's a great question.
You're welcome.
It's more lyrical. Every scene is a painting. It has a certain rhythm to it that other films don't. He doesn't go into major close-ups. He avoids all that stuff. He shoots the film in his head originally. You know, he'll come in and go, okay, I'm going to do this scene. We're going to do a master shot. Then we'll cut to a two shot, and that's it. Or one of the favorite examples I use is the river scene with James Stewart and Richard Widmark in Two Road Together. And Ford reportedly walked out into the middle of the river, said, here, put the camera here. They came out, put the camera there, and they shot a two shot of Stewart and Widmark talking on the riverbank. And that was it. Ford never went into a close-up, a two-shot. He didn't need it. He got what he wanted with the reaction of the two men. So that's one of the things about Ford. Also, he didn't move the camera like it was a roller coaster ride, like they do now. You need to take Dramamine when you're watching some of these movies. He said you only move the camera when it's important. Case in point, in The Searchers, there's that shot where they're at the fort, the white women have been taken, brought back, and they're captives, and there's that one woman that's gotten crazy, and she's cooing over the rag doll that Martin had. And as Wayne walks to the door following the captain to see the dead bodies, he stops and he turns, and the camera moves in on Wayne's face. And then Wayne turns and walks away. Well, you know, right there, it's like, wow, you know. He's saying, without saying, if I find Debbie and she's like this, she's a dead girl. I'm not going to allow her to live that life. In She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, when he goes to talk to Pony That Walks.
Pony That Walks, my heart is sad at what I see. Your young men painted for war. Their scalp knives red. The medicine drum's talking. It is a bad thing.
Pony That Walks says, too late, Nathan, too late. We're too old for war. And Ford goes to a close-up of Wayne, who just nods, yes, we are too old for war, but old men should stop wars. So he used that close-up as an impactful sight to show that Brittles wanted to stop this war. He didn't do a medium shot. He went in tight on Wayne for that one specific reason. What you have with Ford, it's lyrical, and almost all his Westerns are a Charles Russell painting come to life.
I was just going to say, in reading it, it seems like, and this is actually common, I think, with some of the great talents of that era. Buster Keaton comes to mind also, going further back, and that is that they didn't regard themselves as artists, really regarded themselves more as craftsmen, but yet there is an art. And in looking at these films, I think of a couple of shots specifically in Rio Grande, that if they were frozen, if they were still frames, and some, you know, one of these apps was applied to them that turns images into kind of paintings, It would look like a Charles Russell painting or Thomas Moran or something like that, depending upon, you know, whether it was people or a landscape, that sort of thing. So there definitely is a notable artistry there. So I'm going to throw you a variation of that other question now, in terms of how is a John Ford Western different from other Westerns? How is a John Ford collaboration with John Wayne different from other John Wayne pictures?
Boy, that's another good question.
I'm on a roll.
You are on a roll. Wayne's acting in a Ford film doesn't dominate like it does in other films. If you look at the films he does with Henry Hathaway, who was a great director for Wayne, by the way, or Andrew McLaughlin, Wayne is the focus of the story in those non-John Ford films. In John Ford films, yes, he may be an essential character to the story. Certainly, you've got to argue that Ethan in The Searchers is the main focus. But it's a whole totally different John Wayne than what we've seen in True Grit, Sons of Katie Elder, Chisholm, those films done by Hathaway or McLaughlin. And Wayne, like all good actors, they had a bag of tricks they would use in their performing. My dad had it, you know, whether you do a certain look or you say a line a certain way, whatever it is. It's these little bags of tricks that all really, really great actors would rely on. Maybe the way he, well, like in True Grit, look at Wayne's character in True Grit, which he plays something totally different than he ever did. But he still relies on certain little tricks, whether it's the way he delivers a line, the way he looks, or the way he maybe plays when he's drunk. You look at Ford films, Ford didn't allow him to use a lot of these tricks. He kind of kept him on a tight rein and just, you did what the old man wanted. You didn't do what you thought might work or go into your bag of tricks. With Ford, you had to act, and you had to act naturally and realistically. And not that Wayne didn't in these other films, but there's more of a nuanced performance of John Wayne in every John Ford film.
I think all the non-Ford films that Wayne made, it's almost like I don't think of him as this character. I think of him as John Wayne, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas the Ford films, you think of him as the character. And the only other director who I think really brought that out with Wayne was Howard Hawks in Red River.
Yes, yes, very much so. You're absolutely right. And that's where I go back to the terminology that he had a bag of tricks. John Wayne, the actor, had a bag of tricks. And when he played in non-Ford films or non-Hawks films, he relied more on these tricks. I mean, he loved Henry Hathaway. He thought he was a great guy. He loved his directing. Andy, of course, he took care of. A lot of times, Wayne would step in and say, I think we ought to shoot the scene this way, da, 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 da. And Andy would acquiesce because he knew better than to argue with Wayne. Really, the only non-John Ford film where he gives a non-John Wayne performance is The Cowboys, I think.
Yeah.
You can see the actor in him. And I mean that in a good sense, that the talent that he had absorbed all those years comes to the fro. And he had to really prove himself to Mark Rydell. He couldn't just do what he wanted to do or insist on stuff. Rydell would tell him, no, I want you to do it this way, or blah, 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 blah. So I think that's another reason. But with Ford, he's, wow, boy, this is, it's almost kind of, it stumps me in a way to try to describe it, but Ford made him act without acting, if that makes sense. You can see that from the get-go in Stagecoach. I don't think he would have given as good a performance even with Howard Hawks at that point, because I don't think he was that confident in himself as an actor in a big film. You know, he was used to doing the B films, and now he is playing the major leagues. But Ford was the right man to introduce him to Hollywood and give him his stardom.
Yeah, you used a phrase earlier that I know a lot of people would kind of choke on, getting kind of on their, as you might say, high horse, and that is referring to John Wayne as a good actor. I believe that. May not have been a great actor in the sense of, you know, an Olivier or an Al Pacino or someone who showed an amazing versatility, But the thing is, even though John Wayne was playing John Wayne, you always believed him, the Conqueror notwithstanding.
Oh.
Temujin, under his heel, the cowering nations, in his arms, the unconquered woman. He took what he wanted when he wanted it. Boratai meets his fire with ice, matches his fury with flame.
Your hatred will kindle into love.
Before that day dawns, Mongol, the vultures will have feasted on your heart.
That's not a given that you can play yourself and be believable on screen. But he did.
I'm going to come to his defense in The Conqueror. Even though it was an awful film, he doesn't phone it in. He puts something behind it, even though that dialogue just really limited him.
You do well, Kumlik. For while I have fingers to grasp a sword and eyes to see, your treacherous head is not safe on your shoulders, nor your daughter in her bed.
But he gives his best performance that he can with the material he's got. But granted, yes, that and Jet Pilot, oy, I can't watch either one of them. But Wayne trusted Ford implicitly. If Ford said to John Wayne, jump off that rock, John Wayne would jump off that rock. You know, there was a trust there. And you don't have that in a lot of director-actor relationships now. You might say it with Scorsese and De Niro, but honestly, I think De Niro's past his prime. I think most of the time lately in the last 20 so years, maybe the exception of Heat, he basically phones things in, I feel. And yes, Wayne was never going to be a threat to Laurence Olivier, but Laurence Olivier could never be John Wayne.
That's very true.
Same thing with Al Pacino and John Wayne. Wayne could have played some of those parts that Pacino did. I'm thinking like the detective in Heat, maybe a couple others, but I don't see Al Pacino as Richard Cogburn or Captain Nathan Brittles. He just doesn't have what Wayne brought to the role.
Right.
And you say that about other actors. It's like, I've always felt that Joel McRae should have played Shane and not Alan Ladd. Alan Ladd does a good performance, don't get me wrong, but I do wish George Stevens was able to have picked somebody else. Unfortunately, he couldn't because of budgetary things, and Paramount said, you got to use our people.
Hmm. Well, you touched on part of the answer to this next question, I think. And we're talking about, just so that we're not taking too much for granted here, but when we say the cavalry trilogy, we're talking about Fort Apache, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and Rio Grande. Now, you mentioned that they were all based on stories by the same author. What other elements caused them to be considered a trilogy? And when were they first regarded as a trilogy? And do you know who first gave them that label?
Well, they all came out. You had Fort Apache came out in 48. She Wore a Yellow Ribbon came out in 49. And Rio Grande came out in 50. So they were literally, with the exception of Ford doing Three Godfathers, they were all back to back to back, pretty much. The trilogy didn't really become known as a trilogy until the 60s. I don't know who, it was some film historian writer came up with the terminology trilogy. I never found it in any kind of an interview with Ford, although he didn't give that many interviews, prior to the mid-60s. And he did say that he never planned it as a trilogy. I think he just found, well, first off, it gave him a chance to go to Monument Valley, although Rio Grande was shot in Moab because that was done through Republic Pictures. And Mr. Tightwad himself, Herbert Yates, didn't want to spend the money to send everybody to Monument Valley. It was cheaper to go to Moab because they had an airport there. They had motels there, so that you didn't have to bring everything in like you did in Monument Valley, as far as tents, food, water, et cetera, et cetera.
I was really interested in reading about the relationship between John Ford and Yates, because I always wondered about that, because I figured there must have been fireworks in there, you know.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. Well, you know, Wayne really wanted to do a story about the Alamo. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to when he was at Republic. And I'm talking probably late 40s, because after, I think it was after Quiet Man, he walked out of Republic and basically told Yates to go screw himself. And Yates kept stalling them off. Yates kind of choked that at that time, the budget was estimated to be somewhere about $1.2 million, which eventually, as we know, was higher when we finally got around to filming it. And Yates kind of used it as a carrot and stick approach. He kept the carrot, which was Wayne wanting to make the Alamo and Yates saying, yeah, okay, let's talk about it. But in the meantime, I need you to make this movie. And he kind of baited Wayne along. And then finally, it got to a point where Yates flat out told him no. And then as the ultimate screw you, after Wayne has left Republic, Yates turns around and makes The Last Command, which is not a bad little movie about the Alamo. And that really infuriated Wayne and just fanned his flames to say, okay, I'm going to make the Alamo movie, which despite its preachy dialogue and some things not being terribly accurate, I still think it's a very, very good film. Was it well directed? Not bad. I often wonder, my God, what if Ford had done it? Yes, he did shoot scenes in the film that are in the film, but boy, what he could have done with that movie. But the thing, like you say, with Yates, yeah, it was very volatile. Even in the case of Rio Grande, Wayne was supposed to get participation check, a percentage check of Sands of Iwo Jima, which came out in 49. And Yates didn't deliver on it. So they were filming Rio Grande at Republic. And one day Wayne refused to come in. And he told Ford why. So Ford is sitting there with everybody on the set. Nothing gets turned over. The second day, nothing's happening. And Yates comes down and says, why aren't you filming something? And Ford basically said, well, I'll start filming when you pay my star. And Yates got the message, Wayne got the check, and he was back at work the next day. So yeah, it was hardly a love relationship between Yates and Wayne, and certainly the same can be said for Yates and Ford, especially when it came to doing Quiet Man. Oh boy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they really locked horns.
Now, these were not the only cavalry films that John Ford made. He made two others that I'm aware of, one of which starred John Wayne. They were done later, The Horse Soldiers, and then Sergeant Rutledge. How do the films of the cavalry trilogy, how are they distinctive from those later cavalry films?
Well, Horse Soldiers is all Civil War, and the ending falls flat. Really kind of a letdown, you know. It's a real letdown. Really good movie.
It was interesting, too, the part where you were talking about when they ran the screening of The Quiet Man and Ford just had the projectionist cut it off at 111 minutes.
Yeah, because he didn't want to let, he said, well, you said 2 hours, there we go. He got the message across to Yates. And Yates drove him crazy because while Ford's over there filming The Quiet Man, he's sending Ford telegrams saying, everything's so green. You're dealing with an idiot, you know?
Yeah. That kind of reminded me of the story about when Ford was directing a film at Goldwyn in the 30s. And some junior executive from Goldwyn, you know, because he didn't allow executives to come down to the set,
no.
You know.
No.
And some junior executive got down to the set and came up and told him that he was running like about 2 pages behind where he should be at this point of the shooting, you know. And so Ford was like, I'm sorry. Could somebody bring me the script? And so he's looking and he goes, oh, well, how many pages do you think I should be shooting a day? And he said, well, you should be shooting 3 to 4. And he goes, okay, there's 8 pages, rips them out of the script and says, okay, we're back on time, you know.
Yeah.
So
now, where exactly that story happens varies by who tells it.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, it is true, but it's like Chuck Hayward, the stuntman, said it happened on Rio Grande.
Oh, okay.
Joseph LaChelle and Harry Carey Jr. said it happened at Fox, and it could have happened at Goldwyn. Who knows? But the important thing is that whatever pages he tore out, he never shot.
Yeah.
that's one of my favorite stories about Ford.
Yeah.
You know, I often wish Ford had done a few more films based on the Civil War, because he was such a historian about it. I mean, he knew so much that I wish he kind of would have made another, at least one other Civil War film. Sergeant Rutledge, well, you have a whole different story. You're doing, first off, you're doing a story that really couldn't have been done during the time of the Cavalry Trilogy because production code wouldn't have allowed it. You're dealing with a black man accused of murdering a white girl. In the 40s, that would have been pretty much a hard thing to do. As the 60s came along, they were able to do it because it was, how do I want to say?
Well, society, enlightened time.
Yes, society had changed. You know, the Production Code Administration was on its way out in that time period. They'd begun in a couple of years. And I don't think they had as much teeth as they did in the late 40s. I think Sergeant Rutledge is a very good film. I told Woody Strode when I got to work with him on Buck Rogers, he sat down in my chair and the first thing I said to him, I said, "You were robbed." And he looked at me and I said, "You should have gotten an Oscar for Sergeant Rutledge." Well, he and I became instant friends and started talking forward. And he always called, and when I finished doing his makeup, he said, "I always felt they should have buried him in Monument Valley." And I agree. I think that would have been great because Ford loved that place. But he is the only director, to my knowledge, that has a place named after him in Monument. Well, not just in Monument Valley, but anywhere. There's the very famous John Ford Point, which, for real trivia, the first movie he ever shot a scene on John Ford Point was The Searchers, when Ethan is looking down at Scar's camp when he and the soldiers are going to charge through it. And then again in 1964 in Cheyenne Autumn, there's one brief shot of Richard Widmark and the Cavalry walking and riding out to the point and looking around. So those were the two times that John Ford paint, and it's my favorite place in Monument Valley. I keep threatening one of these days I'm going to bring a chair and just set it out there and just sit there all day and watch the world go by.
Well, it seems like you got a little bit close with some of those recent Facebook postings, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I walk right out there. My wife won't go anywhere near it. She's like, no, thank you. I've gone right out to the very edge, you know. It's just such a beautiful place. And you can tell that Ford really loved Monument Valley. He just, more than any other location in any John Ford film, Monument Valley isn't just a location. Monument Valley is a character in the movie. It becomes its own character. And no other place tops it. I mean, you look at Two Road Together. Yeah. Texas isn't too exciting in that area where they shot, especially the time of the year. You don't have the various cloud formations and things. And then Horse Soldiers was all done down in Louisiana and that in the swamps. But boy, you go to Monument Valley, you know where you are. And most importantly, most people know you're in a John Ford film.
Now, you spend a good deal of time in the book talking about John Ford's, or what was known and referred to as John Ford's stock company.
Yes.
And that, at least as far as these three pictures go, of course, John Wayne was there at the top, but you've also got Victor McLaughlin, Ben Johnson.
Harry Carey Jr.
Harry Carey Jr.
Right.
Mildred Natwick, Arthur Shields. Then you got all his iodine squad. You got the meaning, the stuntman. You got Cliff Lyons, Fred Graham, Ray Hike, Tom Tyler, Fred Kennedy, good Chuck Hayward, bad Chuck Roberson. I have to explain that. Ford gave him those nicknames because Chuck Hayward was a good guy. You know, he was like the Boy Scout. Chuck Roberson was, he was the scamp of the group. And there's a story I have in there during the making of Rio Grande. Chuck brought a girl back to his room. And she proceeded to vocalize her enjoyment, shall we say. And the next morning, Ford comes up and he's adjusting Roberson's bandana and that and his hat. And he says, You know, could you please tell the young ladies to keep it down? The rest of us are trying to sleep. Now, to his dying day, Chuck Roberson had no idea how Ford knew. He said, but he knew. He knew everything that went on that set, on any set. But that's how Chuck Roberson got his nickname, Bad Chuck.
Was Chuck Hayward the same guy who was in The Stuntman?
No.
I remember it was Chuck.
Yeah, Charles Bale. That's who it was.
Oh, right.
He played Chuck Barton. But Charles Bale, he had been a stuntman for many, many years.
Right.
And see, in order to do stunts in movies, you had to be a member of Screen Actors Guild. That's why almost all those guys, not almost, but all those guys, they did stunts, but they also could do dialogue. In Rio Grande, Chuck Hayward got hurt. He was to do a drag off a horse. As he starts to take the fall off the horse kicked him in the head. And he had a concussion and a fractured skull. So they sent him to a hospital, and then he came back. But by then, Republic Pictures took him off and put him on disability, workman's comp. And Ford was livid, just livid. And he called up Republic and said, "You don't dismiss an actor. I dismiss the actor. I need him here." Well, what Ford did is he kept him on salary for the run of the film, and Chuck couldn't do any stunts. So he gave Chuck the part of one of the officers in the film. There's a scene where Maureen O'Hara is ironing some clothes, and there's two officers there. One is Peter Ortiz, and the other is Chuck Hayward. And he thanks her for the coffee, and her time goes off. So he had this little part that he did that was Ford's way of keeping him on salary and making money.
Yeah, you talk about his loyalty to people who he worked with or worked for him. And that was something that really stood out to me. Now, another element that struck me in watching these three was the amount of music interwoven through the films, and especially Rio Grande. I mean, that one, it seems, almost qualifies as a musical, given the number of songs that are in there, mostly rendered by Sons of the Pioneers, featuring Ken Curtis.
Sir, traditional singers would like to sing.
The regimental singers.
That's just what I was going to say, sir. The regimental singers would like to sing a traditional song, sir, for himself.
Very good, Quincannon.
Carry on.
Donnelly, sing it, bless you.
Well, Herbert Yates never saw a Western he didn't think would be better with music, especially singing cowboys. The first two, the score is by Richard Hageman, who, for trivia folks, he actually appears in The Three Godfathers as the saloon piano player towards the end of the movie. Hageman's score can be effective or can be overused, but I found in the two films, both Fort Apache and in Yellow Ribbon, his score works very, very well. Now, when it came to Rio Grande, Ford had decided to use, he had used Sons of the Pioneers for the songs in the movie Wagon Master. And at that point, Ford's daughter, Barbara, and Ken Curtis had fallen in love. So Ford decided to use Sons of the Pioneers so he could feature Ken in a couple of scenes and give him some more footage and more screen time. And you also had Victor Young doing the score. I think it's a really good score. I really do. I think Victor Young did a great job. Kind of makes me wonder what he could have done with Yellow Ribbon or Fort Apache, but we'll never know. Young also went on to do the score for Quiet Man as well.
Okay. I was interested to see some of the things that made the other films, or well, the various films distinctive, the three films distinctive. Let's be precise in our terminology here. One thing that particularly intrigued me was the use of infrared film stock on Fort Apache.
For the exteriors, only for the exteriors. All interiors were done with normal black and white film stock.
What led to the infrared being used for the exteriors?
Well, they originally wanted to shoot in Technicolor, and they couldn't because of the budget. They were constrained and couldn't do it, so Archie Stout suggested, the cinematographer, he suggested, well, look, we could use this black and white infrared for your exteriors, which will make the clouds stand out more against the screen and give it a certain depth that you wouldn't get with normal black and white. So Ford said, sure, let's do that. Ford loved shooting in black and white. He once said you could hire anybody to do color photography, but to shoot in black and white, film black and white, he said, is a real art. And he certainly proved that in so many of his movies.
So that raises the question then, if he preferred black and white, why was She Wore a Yellow Ribbon filmed in Technicolor?
The maddening thing about Ford is he never wrote any notes. If he didn't talk about it to his grandson, whose recordings I listened to, you're kind of, well, first off, on Ford Apache, John Wayne, Henry Fonda, and Shirley Temple were getting $100,000 each for the film, $10,000 a week. So right there, you got $30,000 in your budget. In Yellow Ribbon, you only had Wayne getting $100,000. Everybody else got less, so they could do it that way. And I think Ford wanted to shoot in color. He certainly says in that one note to James Warner Bella, he says that, you know, it had never been photographed in Technicolor and that it would really stand out. Yeah, he says here, Monument Valley had never been shot in Technicolor, adding it should be breathtaking. Well, he was right about that. So, and it was just another way to sell the film. It just wouldn't be another black and white Western. It would stand out in Technicolor. And Ford knew that valley so well that he knew what areas looked good in the morning, what areas looked good in the afternoon, what areas looked good in the afternoon and late afternoon. So he knew how to take advantage of the lighting there. So I think that's the reason. I think he wanted to shoot it in Technicolor. And it was also a good marketing ploy.
Yeah.
A very good ploy.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, jumping back to Fort Apache, again, another one of the stories that stood out to me was Ben Johnson. Now, Fort Apache was his first film for Ford?
Fort Apache is his first film with Ford. He was working as a wrangler / stuntman. Matter of fact, he doubled Henry Fonda in certain scenes writing-wise. Like when you see when Thursday is going back to his command to make their stand against the Apaches and he's bouncing along in the saddle, that's Ben. That's not Henry Fonda. So he did that. But then on Fort Apache, what won him the loyalty of Ford was they were shooting a scene out at Corgan Ranch where they're come to pick up the dead bodies and repair the telegraph line. And an Indian shot goes off and John Agar says, leave everything, let's go, let's take off. And the Agar and one of the sergeants ride up on a horse and in the wagon follows. And it's a six-up wagon, meaning there's six horses pulling the wagon. And there's a different angle that's looking to the left as the wagon comes up this narrow road and then makes a sharp right turn. And as it does, you can see that the wagon's left rear wheel starts to leave the ground. And then it cuts to another shot in Monument Valley of the wagon going full out. Well, what audience did not see was that wagon actually flipped on its side and the horses went wild. The driver lost control of the lines. The horses were dragging the wagon with three stuntmen, and it was heading for a rock wall. And if the horses kept going where they were going, they would have been seriously injured or killed, and so would have the stuntmen. In most cases, you have always off camera, you will have one or two wranglers mounted on horses when they're driving a wagon or a buckboard or something. So if the actor or the stunt guys lose control for some reason, they can jump in there to help. Well, Ben was doing just that. He was right by the platform where the camera was up, and he saw what happened, and he spurred his horse right in. He got to the lead horse on the left, and he grabbed him by the bridle, and he stacked the horses up, meaning they ran into each other, but they didn't get hurt. And prevented the wagon and the horses from smashing into the rock wall. Ford gets off the camera parallel and he says to Ben, he says, you'll be well rewarded for that. And Ben always figured, well, I guess I'll get some more stunt work. Well, about a week later, he's called into Ford's office at the RKO Culver Studios, or the old Selznick Studios, as it was known. And he hands Ben a manila envelope that wasn't sealed. And he says, I want you to have your lawyer look at this. Well, since it wasn't sealed, Ben opens it up and he sees a 7-year contract with Argosy Productions, Ford's company. He said, I got down to the bottom part of the first page where it said they'd pay me $5,000 a week. He said, I reached over, took a pen from Ford's desk and signed it right away. And that's how Ben Johnson became Ben Johnson, the movie star.
And I gather part of Ford's stock company for a period of time.
A short period of time, yeah.
And I think that stock company, all those actors being together, is another thing that makes that trilogy. Because it's almost the same cast in all three films.
Yes. And it does, and they do have a very, very much an ensemble feel in more of a way than something like Rio Lobo, where you've got several good actors doing several great parts, but there's still a more obvious hierarchy in terms of the character and so forth. Whereas it really does feel more evenly distributed in terms of their contributions to the story and the relationships to the from one character to another in those three films.
Well, in Ford's films, the stock company players dovetail into each other so well, and that nobody is trying to outdo the other person. And yes, one actor might have a moment in a movie that stands out for them, but no one's trying to showboat and say, look at me, I'm here. They all, first off, you couldn't do it with Ford. He wouldn't allow that. He put an end to that real quick, and you would not be back with Ford. But also, it was just, for Ford, it made his job easier because he didn't have to tell them how to act. He knew that he could rely on them and he'd say, all right, you'll come through here and you do this and you'll say your lines here, blah, 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 blah. And he might come up with a bit of business for one of them, but that's it. He didn't tell them how to read their lines or how to act. He trusted them. He knew what they could deliver. And you look at Frank Capra did the same thing. Hawks, in some case, who was a Wild Bill Wellman, always had George Chandler in a part in his film because he knew he could always rely on George Chandler. No matter how big it was, no matter how small it was, he was one of these actors that he relied on and knew he could say his lines and I don't have to direct him. I don't have to do anything. Lucy was that way with many actors, including my dad. She could hire my dad on an episode. He knew exactly what she wanted. He didn't have to ask. And it just makes a person's job easier, director's job easier, and it's more fun, you know.
Sure. Now, although both John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara had worked for John Ford prior to Rio Grande, that was their first pairing, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And it was their second pairing because Wayne appears in a supporting part in the stage play, What Price Glory, that Ford put on in 1949. He wasn't the lead actor in it. That was Ward Bond and Pat O'Brien and Maureen O'Hara, but Wayne was in it. But I've always felt, and others do, that Maureen's part in Rio Grande was kind of an unofficial screen test between her and Wayne.
So it was their first on-screen pairing in any case.
It was their first on-screen pairing, correct. And I think it was, if Ford wasn't sure, he was sure after that movie, because my God, the chemistry between the two of them. I cite in the book that one scene where they're having dinner in his tent and they just look at each other and say nothing, but the looks and the chemistry and the sexual tension and emotion between them just explodes. And what always amazed me, not one movie critic, including the great Bosley Crowther, picked up on that and mentioned it in their reviews.
I guess after another picture or two with the two of them, it became something that couldn't be overlooked.
Well, it definitely became very obvious with Quiet Man. They just had such a great chemistry together. Wayne always said O'Hara was a great guy. She was one of the gang.
Which of the three films would you say was the most challenging to film and or complete?
Well, in one respect, Fort Apache was, because they were in Monument Valley in July. Mm-hmm. That can get up to over 100 degrees. And out in Simi Valley, where the fort set was built at Corrigan Ranch, that also got up to 100 degrees. So that there, and they also had some occasional dust storms that showed up in Monument Valley during the location shoot there. So that was taxing on people. I think out of all of them, Yellow Ribbon was one of the easiest shoots they ever did. And again, in Moab, when they were doing Rio Grande, they were there again in the summer. And I remember Harry Carey Jr. and Claude Yarman Jr. telling me, they said the thing they remember most about Moab was the heat. Claude Yarman said, well, at least it wasn't humid like it was in Florida for the yearling. But he says, yeah, it was hot. And they were in military uniforms and that.
Yeah. So it might have been a hard one to get done also because of just working for Yates.
Well, yeah, but I don't think that would have trickled down. That would not have trickled down to the actors. Certainly would have trickled down to Ford. But everything I've been able to find, Yates didn't give him a hard time on that film, other than he insisted, no, you got to shoot it not in Monument Valley. But Ford got even. He had Harry Goulding bring 60 Navajo men with him to play the Apaches, including two of his favorites, Many Mules and Jack Stanley. They were in every film Ford did, from Stagecoach, anytime they shot Monument Valley. Yates pretty much left them alone because he just said, I need a black and white Western, and it's got to be shot. The only time where I think he had any problems with Yates was when he refused to pay Wayne his money for Sands of Iwo Jima, his percentage. And Wayne just walked off the set, and Ford didn't care. He agreed with him. Yeah. So,
of the three films, is one more highly regarded than the others? And by the same token, do you have a personal favorite of the three?
Well, my personal flat-out favorite is She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. That movie and The Searchers are tied as my number one favorite films. I love She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. Obviously, the Technicolor does a lot for it. And as I was writing this book and writing about Yellow Ribbon and looking at Wayne's character in that, I grew to love it more because I could relate to Brittles being forced to retire from a job you love. In my case, I just decided enough was enough. It was time to get out of doing makeup. I just could understand Wayne's character so well, and that there was so much for me personally that I identified with. But I've always loved Yellow Ribbon the most. I mean, that scene with Ben Johnson riding with the as the Indians are chasing him. Oh, man, I could watch that on a loop all day. A lot of people like Fort Apache. It's taken me a while to warm up to Fort Apache. I do like it. I do respect Ford's filmmaking of it. I think for me, what was kind of hard was Henry Fonda's character was such an ass.
Colonel, if you send out the regiment, Cochise will think I've tricked him.
Exactly. We have tricked him. Tricked him into returning to American soil, and I intend to see that he stays here.
Colonel Thursday, I gave my word to Cochise. No man is going to make a liar out of me, sir.
Your word to a breech-clouded savage? An illiterate, uncivilized murderer and treaty breaker? There's no question of honor, sir, between an American officer and Cochise.
There is to me, sir.
There was nothing nice about him. And it was like, God, you won't even listen to the guys who have been out here. But I think Fort Apache has, in a way, a stronger story. Sure, Yellow Ribbon is very much like My Darling Clementine. Is you have a few things going on until you come up to the end. Now, like in My Darling Clementine, you know it's going to be the gunfight at the OK Corral. So how do we get there? And how we get there is this kind of lyrical, meandering story that you're not really aware builds. Same thing with Yellow Ribbon. You're looking at a man who's facing the end of his duty as a soldier. And you got this Indian problem, and then you got the love triangle, and it kind of meanders here. You got this story here and this story here, and then boom, he decides he's going to right the wrong that he couldn't fix and stop the Indian War. They build it so well, you're not aware when you're watching it. While this story is meandering, it's really building steps to the final outcome. You don't realize it when you're watching it. Rio Grande was very much an accurate film about cavalry life, where the guys ride in and they get off their horses. They got to walk the horses, water them, feed them, and all that. Then they can go to the sutler's store and get a drink. And then, of course, you have the mother-son story, and you have the son trying to get his father's approval, and then what's going to happen with Wayne and Maureen O'Hara. And boy, in the script, she's not a very nice person. She kind of comes off not quite a shrew, but, you know, she doesn't translate to what we want to see. Now, in the film, you do see that transition coming. It slowly builds and then builds into her and him reuniting. And, you know, the son is given a commendation for saving the children and all that. So it's, I'll still go with She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. My money's on that one.
Fair enough. All right. Well, this has been another great conversation. Now, since you've been on the podcast before and I've asked you my standard question about your most memorable movie going experience, I've got to use my backup question now, which is, if you could rent out a movie palace and invite a few hundred of your closest friends to have a screening, what movie would you show them?
Can I give you an A and B answer or an ABC answer?
Sure. We don't stand on formality here.
If you were asking me about Lon Chaney, I would say either Tell It to the Marines or While the City Sleeps. While the City Sleeps, he plays a police detective. Wonderful film. Even though it's missing a reel, it doesn't hurt the story. My B and C films, I would actually make it a double feature. And it would be The Searchers and She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. Sit through both of them. Tough duty, I know, but they'll get through it.
Well, if you're there, you know, providing an introduction or a Q&A afterwards, then I'm sure there would be no problem with that.
Sounds good.
Well, Michael, it's been great having you back on to talk about this. And again, we're talking about your new book, The Cavalry Trilogy, John Ford, John Wayne, and the making of three classic Westerns. Very much a worthwhile read for anyone who has any interest whatsoever in Westerns, in John Wayne, and John Ford, or just a good read on cinema history. So, Michael, once again, thank you for joining us on Movie Nights and Matinees.
I'm always glad to be here. It's always a joy to talk movies with you.
Thanks, Michael.
And you too.
Of course, you can find an Amazon link to Michael's book on the bookshelf page of the podcast website, and links for the three films that make up the Cavalry Trilogy can be found on the Screening Room page. Don't forget to click on the follow, subscribe, or download button, as the case may be, wherever you listen, and please leave a rating and, where possible, a review. And remember to visit the Movie Nights and Matinees Facebook page, where you can leave more detailed comments or questions and find additional material related to the podcast episode topics and sometimes classic movies in general. I look forward to having you join us in a couple of weeks for episode 31.
You see, this is my life. It always will be. There's nothing else. Just us. And the cameras. And those wonderful people out there in the dark.